Welcome to the iCoder Podcast with Ian McDuff.
Hello once again, podcast and ODR audience, and welcome to this next iCoder podcast. I'm Ian McDuff, and again, I'm speaking with you from Wellington in Aotearoa, New Zealand. In this conversation, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Nicolas Vermees. And Nicolas is the director of the Centre de Recherche en Droit Public and associate director of the Cyber Justice Laboratory and a professor at the Université de Montréal, Faculté de Droit. Nicolas is a member of the Quebec Bar, Certified Information Systems Security Professional. I may have to come back to ask you about that. And the author of numerous publications relating to the impact of technology on the law. What I'll do is I'll put a link to your online bio on the podcast link so that people can follow up on those publications. Nicolas's research focuses on legal issues pertaining to artificial intelligence, information security, developments in the field of cyber justice, and other questions relating to the impact of technological innovations on the law. He's often invited to speak on those topics by the media and regularly lectures for judges, lawyers, professional orders, and the government organizations in Canada and abroad. So welcome to this podcast series, Nicolas. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me in the series.
It's a pleasure being here.
Great. So could we begin the conversation with a general question? I received the bulletins from the Cyber Justice Laboratory, which I find compelling and more than I can read. Could you, for our audience, say something about the mission and the work of the Cyber Justice Laboratory, please?
Of course. So the lab was created in 2010. So we've celebrated our 10th birthday during the pandemic. We've now passed those days. And basically, our goal was to see how technology could be used to increase access to justice. We've been working on ODR questions and issues for decades already. My colleague, Karim Benicleff, who is the actual founder of the lab, was one of the first researchers to work on ODR back in the 90s with Ethan Catch, whom your listeners probably know very well at this point, and other experts at the time. And Karim developed the first ODR platform, the Cyber Tribunal, back in 96, made available in 98. And following that came other ODR experiences, e-resolution, EQUIDZ, electronic consumer dispute resolution platform that was available in Europe for many years. And building on all of those experiences, we came to the conclusion that we had established that technology can help gain access to justice, but it had always been developed in as an alternative to the courts. And our goal was really to see, well, can we import all that knowledge into how we can develop technological solutions to increase access to justice and incorporate them within the legal process? And that's really the genesis of the Cyber Justice Laboratory. So what the lab is physically, it's a physical infrastructure. It's the most technologically advanced courtroom in Canada. So courtroom that is fully equipped with cameras, tablets, and all the bells and whistles. Attached to that is a computer lab where we have developers and students and social scientists and basically people who are working with us in the lab developing the next generation of applications. So whether it be ODR applications or other technological tools to increase access to justice.
There's one immediate question arises for me. It's an image that you talked about of importing technology into the courts over the course of the couple of decades that you and others have been working on ODR, which is different from the image many people have of ODR, which is migrating your practice into a bit of technology. It's a different direction, isn't it? You're bringing the technology into and modifying existing institutions? I mean, are you looking at ways in which those existing practices are modified by the introduction of technology?
Exactly. What we've seen, and most courts are looking into technology, and in fact, with the pandemic, we saw it with a lot of courts moving on to Zoom or Teams, So basically using ODR, right? If you're using the general definition of ODR, which is the use of technology to resolve disputes, then a video conferencing is technically a form of ODR. Not the type that we develop. We're working more on ODR platforms, but still, if you use, again, a broad definition, it perfectly fits into that definition. And courts have had, and it's the case in Canada, it's the case in the US, it's the case almost everywhere around the world. Obviously, courts have huge problems with delays and costs. And so the idea was to see, well, how can we learn from what has been done in the field of ODR to incorporate it into the existing legal process or into existing legal processes? And so, for example, we our ODR platform, the one we developed at the lab, is called Parlay. It's the platform to aid in the resolution of litigation electronically. And Parlay is now being used by different courts and tribunals and public bodies in Canada, where it was incorporated into the process. So it's the classic ODR process, right, of negotiation, then mediation, and then that third and final stage, if you you take the UNSA trial definition, which is usually arbitration in the classic ODR model, but we've replaced it with adjudication. And so basically a court will offer negotiation. If that fails, mediation. And if that fails, then you appear in front of a judge. And what we've seen is statistically more or less the same results as the few public private platforms, I'm sorry, that were a success, like the eBay model, for example. Our statistics are relatively comparable. So we have, for example, in Quebec, Parlay is being used by the Consumer Protection Agency, and it's over 70% of cases that are settled before they reach the adjudication stage. Mm-hmm. And so whereas all these cases beforehand went in front of the small claims court, which in Quebec right now, it's roughly a year before you can get a hearing date. Well, now people in a month can get it settled using negotiation mediation. And should that fail, then they're invited to go to small claims and file a grievance. But obviously, this helps them move things along quite quickly. And so that's how we're seeing basically how do you incorporate ODR into the judicial process to have a seamless process for citizens who, instead of filing a brief which you don't really know exactly how it's supposed to be drafted, especially if you're self-represented, and then waiting a year or two or three or depending on the type of case before you're heard, well, you can go through the negotiation mediation phases. And that makes the process faster for you if it's settled. And on top of it, it liberates judges so that they can spend more time on the cases that require their legal reasoning, i.e. those that couldn't be settled in the negotiation and mediation phases.
So when you talk about the court offering those those preliminary phases, they're offered through a cyber platform.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so how does that work? I mean, and how does the litigant, particularly the self or complainant, let's say at this stage, how does that self-represented complainant access that platform so that they can do the mediation or negotiation and mediation?
So I'll give you an example. So our Parlay platform is also being used by the Condominium Authority Tribunal in Ontario. So Ontario is one of Canada's provinces, the biggest province, the most populated. And they had a big problem in Ontario, I mean, for court purposes, is that a major part of the population lives in condominiums. And so condominium disputes were taking over the courts. And these are not, these are not constitutional matters. These are usually two co-owners that don't get along. So they're neighborly disputes or a dispute between somebody who lives in the condominium and the condominium board, for example. And so the way it works, if I live in a condominium and I have an issue with the board of my condo association or with one of my co-owners, i.e. my neighbors, then I just go on to the Condominium Authority Tribunal website. They have a guided pathway, and can get back to guided pathways later on, but so which will basically explain to them what information they're required to give, and then asking different questions, and will basically guide them to the proper door. And then they can log on to the platform, create an account like you would, you know, create a Facebook account or any other type of website account. You create your account, you enter your personal information, and then you fill out a form that's basically what your grievance is. So you check a few boxes, you fill out a couple of boxes in the form, all extremely user-friendly, so you don't need legal assistance to fill it out. And once that's done, you just press on a button, and obviously I'm cutting corners a little bit, but an email is sent to the platform administrator who makes sure that everything is okay. And once everything is okay, you can simply send a notice to the opposing party. You can either do that through the platform using email if the opposing party has an email address that you know, or you can always print it out and slide it under their door, or mail it to them, or send it by a priority post. And then once the other party gets the notice, they log onto the platform, take notice of what your grievance is. Then you start the negotiation phase. So they can make you an offer, and you can make a counter offer, all using the tools built into the platform, which are mostly forms. And there's obviously a possibility to chat between the parties. And if one of the parties, after a certain while, decides things aren't moving forward, we're not going to reach an agreement, we need help, then they can just press on a button in the on the ODR platform, and that basically sends a message to the platform administrator to attribute a mediator to the process. So then the mediator logs on and starts trying to get the parties to come to an agreement. Again, if that works, great, and usually does. If that doesn't work, then either the mediator or one of the parties can request to go to adjudication. And then a judge, an administrative judge, they're referred to as members in this case. Well, they get seized with that particular case. And again, they log onto the platform, and using the platform, the tools that are built in, they can create the calendar for the different stages of the process. If there are witnesses, how many, when are pleadings due, and so on and so forth. And at the end, when all of that is done, the judge just presses on a button that closes the file, the case, and then they just have access to all the information to draft their decision. And once the decision is drafted, it gets uploaded onto the platform, and both parties can download it and access it. And obviously, depending on what the outcome is, then they might have things that they need to do.
Mm-hmm. So there's not a particular role of AI in this. I mean, we'll come back to that later. But this is this is a facilitated way of giving people access to engaging with each other online. So in a way, it's a very straightforward means of access using technology to allow people to access what they would otherwise do in real life, the conversation.
Yes, it's just done in a way that maximizes the impact of the technology, or rather that uses the strengths of the technology instead of simply copying the current process.
Right.
And so the information is not entered in the same way as you would in a classic court process, where you would have just to write a motion and respect a few elements. Now you're just answering questions, checking boxes, adding information, and in the back end, the system generates the proper documentation. And nice. That's why self-represented litigants can actually use these types of tools. I mean, obviously, I'm not saying that you shouldn't get help from lawyers. I'm a lawyer myself, so I teach at a law school. So the last thing I want is to take work away from my colleagues. But truth be told, a lot of these cases, people either can't afford to have legal aid, or basically it wouldn't be financially viable for them to do so.
Yeah. I mean, there's a comparable issue here in New Zealand, and we're particularly in the employment tribunal, where self-represented litigants turn up with none of the experience and none of the help, and the courts are required, or particularly court staff, are required to spend more time giving the sort of assistance which they really haven't got the time to do. So that You know, we don't want to see self-represented litigants as a burden on the system, but the lack of access which you're trying to remedy does create an issue for those very people, and giving the pathways out of the court, which seems to be a large part of what you're doing. Not taking them away from lawyers, but taking them away from I guess, imposing themselves on the court. But is any part of that process, you talk about the documents being generated automatically, but there's no part of it that is automated negotiations such as Smart Settle or the eBay sort of process?
No, so we don't use blind bidding in our system, simply because, as you mentioned, there's Smart Settle in Canada that develop and then created a great system. So it would be redundant to try to offer that type of tool. But also, just these types of disputes are very often disputes where you need a different approach. Blind bidding systems are great. And again, the Smart Settle product is a great example. And I invite your listeners to have a look at the great work they're doing if they're curious. But it is relatively limited because of the approach. And so it's great for certain types of disputes, not as good for other types. And so it's just a question of what type of dispute are you addressing, and the types of disputes we're addressing are not those that are necessarily best suited by that type of tool.
Sure. I mean, I do hope and expect to come back to talk to more of your Canadian colleagues on that. I mean, the last people I spoke to were based in Toronto, but I certainly want to go back to talk to more of the Smart Settle people because it comes up quite regularly. Could I go back a step or two to talk? Have you talk a bit more about your Parlay program? And you've written it out for me, P-A-R-L, capitalized, and the lowercase e. So we're no doubt playing on French language as well here. But so Parlay is a platform?
It is.
And who accesses it? How does it work?
Parlay, so it started off as a research project. So again, we built back, and I say we, but my colleague Karim Benikleff in this case, built back in the late 90s the Cyber Tribunal platform, and then built on using that same platform, brought it further with the Equidzea platform and the e-resolution platform. And so when I arrived on the team, when I joined his team in 2005, 2006, when we started working together on creating what would become the Cyber Justice Laboratory, again, we looked at what I explained at the very beginning, and that is, well, how do we use all this experience that he had amassed and that his team had amassed to create these ODR platforms and put that at the service of the courts? And so we got government funding to develop an ODR platform that we could then make available to public bodies that want it. And that's how Parlay was born. So you're correct in pointing out the French element. So Parlay, it's PAL in French, which means to speak. And so I came up with the acronym and then made the letters fit. And then in English went, well, how can we translate that into English? And it's actually the funny story. And my brother-in-law had just watched Pirates of the Caribbean. And at the time, there was the expression parlay, and to parlay is to negotiate with an enemy. And that's the main character, Jack Sparrow, I believe his name was, in the movie, constantly shouted that in the first movie. And so when my brother-in-law saw that, he says, parlay, like the pirates who negotiate. I said, that's perfect, because it's negotiating with I wouldn't say an enemy in this case, but somebody you have a disagreement with. So yes, it's the platform to aid in the resolution of litigation electronically, hence the small e. It is a working platform that we work with our partners to adapt to their needs. So as I mentioned, we developed, we adapted it to the needs of the Ontario I'm sorry, condominium authority tribunal, and we had developed it and adapted it to the needs of different public bodies here in Quebec, some partners in Europe as well, and we're now working with other Canadian bodies that I can't name yet because they haven't been that the platform hasn't been launched yet.
But in due course,
there you go.
Watch the space. Thank you for that. You mentioned one other thing too in an early email, your use of your justice bot project. You know, bots have a varying reputation around the world, but a justice bot?
Yeah. So the justice bot started off as a research project with a few of our students, just as a general idea to, and it answers exactly the fears that you just alluded to, that bots don't have a very good reputation. And the main reason for that is that the data that is used to train them, and we are now talking about tools using artificial intelligence and more specifically machine learning, it's not necessarily information that is reliable. So what we did is we launched a pilot project here in Quebec with the housing board. And the housing board, the housing authority, Tribunal Administratif du Logement, basically gave us access to over a million of their decisions. Mm-hmm. And we used that to train the algorithm and for it to be able to, again, aid litigants in getting access to justice. Now, I should mention, this is not a predictive tool. In fact, I hate the very concept of a predictive tool. AI is not an oracle. AI is simply a tool. In fact, I like to refer to Luc Julia, who's a French computer scientist and one of the minds who created Siri, who says the whole idea of artificial intelligence shouldn't be even a concept that we still use. We should talk about augmented intelligence, because that's actually what we're doing. We're augmenting human intelligence. So that's what the justice bot does. It augments the intelligence of future litigants. So for example, if I have an issue, I'm renting an apartment and I have bed bugs or there's no heating. Well, I go on the platform and either I answer questions or I can even in my own words just say, I'm really cold in my apartment. And then the justice bot will say, okay, you say you're really cold in your apartment. That could mean different things. Does it mean that your heating is too low, or does it mean that your windows are broken, or so on and so forth? Then you say, okay, well, yes, the heating is too low. So you click on that, and then it'll start asking you questions. So, well, did you tell the owner of the building? When did you tell him? And what happened, and so on and so forth. And depending on the answers you give the justice bot, it will then say, okay, well, according to the information you gave me, these are five decisions that have a similar fact pattern to yours. And this is the gist of those decisions. So I'm not actually giving you legal advice, and I'm not predicting that you're going to you have a 55% chance of winning or an 85% chance of winning, because statistics, as Benjamin Disraeli used to say, there are three types of lies: lies, damn lies, and statistics. And so these statistics don't really help you, because even if you say you have an 85% chance of winning, well, what I want to know is why I have a 15% chance of losing, and that's what I want to address. So in this case, we're just giving you information saying these are the facts, these are the cases that are similar to yours, and these are the outcomes of those cases from the pool of million cases that our algorithm actually went through and analyzed.
Mm-hmm. So I think one of the key things I'd take away from that too is your emphasis that this is actually giving people access to information, not outcomes.
Exactly. It's giving access to information through and valid information, structured information coming directly from the courts. So this isn't a ChatGPT scenario of hallucinations. Hallucinations are not possible in the present context. Doesn't mean they're not doing research to push the algorithm. And in fact, I just mentioned ChatGPT. We're actually now studying how we can use ChatGPT to facilitate the interface, but to make sure that the data that we use is still very much our data, the core data that's valid, yeah, that's verified, that's quality data, but we can still use more advanced tools like ChatGPT to act as intermediary, if you will, built into the platform to have access.
I'm aware that once ChatGPT hit the headlines, a number of my colleagues in the ODR field started applying, testing it against things like Supreme Court decisions and, you know, basically the body of case law, and found that it's fast, but it's deeply inaccurate in many respects, or it can look plausible and can get a lot of things right, but we can't afford the level of flaws that are built, that, well, they're not built into ChatGPT, but are still there. Whereas it sounds like your justice bot, because it relies on established information on a body of case law, is avoiding, is also not pretending to be anything other than what it is.
Exactly. And again, I'm not saying ChatGPT isn't an interesting tool, but as you mentioned, and the last statistics I saw is roughly 20% of the time it either hallucinates, which means it makes up information, or just gives faulty information, which obviously for legal information is completely unacceptable. And so that's why we're not using that technology to go through the data, but to interface with our own AI in order to make the experience more seamless for users.
Yeah. There's a wider conversation to be had. It was something I began a conversation with Leah Wing in my second of these podcasts, and looking at the ethics and the sort of human dimension of ODR. And cyber justice carries with it a kind of cybernetic fears that many will have. And of course, there's a generation of the legal profession who are probably my age, who are yet to move on from practice, who are cynical, skeptical, and probably terrified about the kinds of things that you're working on here.
Well, so if I could maybe to make them feel a little more secure. So cyber justice, obviously the word exists in both French and English. We had a role to play in defining the word in French. And so the definition that we came up with is really simply facilitating access to justice through the use of technology. So there's really nothing that should be scary about that statement. And in fact, that's what the dictionaries now, the French dictionaries, are using as the official definition of cyber justice. The L'Académie Française in France has integrated it now into the French vocabulary, and same here for here in Quebec. L'Office de la langue française, the body that decides which terms are adequate in French and defines them, is now using the expression. Now, in English, the term had existed prior to our coining it in French. Again, in French, it's a word that's less than 15 years old. And so it might hold a different sense for certain people. But in our view, it's simply facilitating access to justice through the use of technology.
Yeah. And without any larger, more futuristic connotations about the degree to which justice is taken over by the technology, because your role and perception of this as facilitating rather than implementing is important.
Definitely. And you can see that even in the field of ODR. So there are really two opposing views right now in how artificial intelligence is being used and should be used in the field of ODR. There's what I referred to as the AIDR movement, and I didn't coin that expression. It's in the literature, which is basically artificial intelligence dispute resolution, whereas you're basically replacing the quote-unquote third party, so the mediator or the arbitrator, with artificial intelligence. And then there's another movement, which I coined with my colleague, Karim Biniklef. We coined it ODR AI. So ODR aided by augmented intelligence. And we're really working on that end of things. I don't believe in AIDR. for ethical reasons, but also simply because training an algorithm to be able to make legal decisions requires a lot of training data. And that's data that's simply not available. Yeah. It's not available for different reasons. A, because justice is local. And so getting sufficient information to train the algorithm is already difficult. But on top of it, if you're talking about mediation, well, mediation is confidential. So how do you get the data to train the algorithm? So I don't believe in that. But Audrey, using ODR to facilitate access to legal information, to augment the intelligence of parties, well, that's exactly what the Justice Bot is doing. And that's what we're building our work on AI around. I should mention that the lab is heading a huge international project called ACT, Autonomy Through Cyber Justice Technologies and Artificial Intelligence. And we have more than 40 researchers from everywhere around the world who are working with us and collaborating on basically seeing how AI can be used to increase access to justice. But again, not to replace judges or lawyers, but to give every stakeholder in the legal process more information so that they can do their job better or simply have a better understanding of the impact of any type of decision.
You know, one thing I'd again like to underscore is something that a couple of my other colleagues have mentioned in our exchanges in email or here, is your emphasis on AI as augmented intelligence. And I think that now has become very much a part of our conversation. And because artificial intelligence is kind of scary image, it's the sci-fi part. Whereas what you're looking at is looking at ways in which technology can be not so much a prosthetic device, but ways of assisting the decision making. But there's another question that comes out of just one of your comments just now, which is about what is meant by the justice part of cyber justice. And what you're suggesting, correct me if I misinterpret you here, is that justice per se is always going to be more nuanced than AI can ever manage. It's going to be, in terms of the training of judges, the training of people to make just decisions. But there may well be those who would argue that that's the problem with justice, is that it's nuanced. You know, when you actually don't know what the judge had for lunch, what we want to do is to reduce as much as possible the degree to which it matters whether the members of the Supreme Court are Republican or Democrat. That's the kind of nuance we don't necessarily want to endorse. How do we find that balance between justice as something which is a human quality, human decision-making nuance, and the quest for a greater degree of not predictability, but at least certainty?
So I actually gave a lecture a few years ago to judges, and my very first slide was just judges are biased.
Yeah.
And obviously I got a couple of stern looks and stares. And my second slide was because judges are human. And by definition, therefore, they have biases. And that's true. And there is research to demonstrate, as you mentioned, that depending on what a judge ate, or rather what time of the day it is, if it's before or after lunch, or if their favorite sports team lost the day before, if they argued with their spouse, and so on and so forth, that will have an impact on their decision-making process. But at the same time, if you look at the other end of the spectrum and say, okay, so we want everybody to be treated exactly the same way and not take into consideration any outside information. Well, that would be horrible.
Mm.
Because that would mean treating somebody who's mentally handicapped the same way we're treating somebody who's a genius. And I mean, there are a million discrepancies between individuals that judges have to take into account. And that is reflected in the case law. Now, in certain jurisdictions, there's no decisions or the decisions aren't as complete as in others. But in common law jurisdictions or even in certain civil law jurisdictions like here in Quebec, when you actually read the decision, well, there's a lot of justifications justifying rather why a judge decided A or B. And you can't get that level of analysis from AI because, again, there's just not enough training data.
Mm.
So in Quebec, for example, there are roughly 25,000 decisions a year that are available from the higher courts, obviously. And Joshua Bengio, whom you might have heard of, who's one of the premier researchers in artificial intelligence, and I'm lucky enough to have him as a colleague here at the University of Montreal. And so we were discussing with him whether it would be even feasible for there to be an AI judge. And so he asked that question, how many decisions are there per year? And we said roughly 25,000. He says, it's impossible. He says, even if all those 25,000 decisions were on the exact same legal issue, it would still take a decade before you had enough data to train an algorithm to be even remotely close to what a judge can do. And that's not taking into account the fact that, well, laws change and they evolve, and that society evolves. If everybody is always treated the same way as they are today, well, that means that social rights end today. Right? Sure. There's the social right movement will never again evolve. Looking in the past, you know, women would never have had the right to vote if AI was in charge at the time, because AI is just looking at what happened in the past and reapplying it to the future. So we're basically going to have a stagnant legal system if that's the approach we want to have. And so that that in itself creates an untenable situation.
Two more questions at least emerge for me out of this. One is because I saw one of your publications with a colleague on ODR as a public service, and because you're now alluding to the more public and critical dimensions of decision making and judging, in what way is ODR a public service?
So the reason we use that title and the way we framed it is, so historically, ODR was always a private offering, right? ODR is a play on ADR, and ADR is alternative dispute resolution. And what is an alternative to? It's an alternative to the courts. So ODR, when you look at the literature at the very beginning, if you look at the first books by Ethan Katz or other colleagues, well, that's the idea that they had in mind, this private way of giving people access to justice. The problem is, looking back at the past now 25 years about of the ODR movement, there haven't been that many private ODR platforms that are success stories. Everybody's always talking about eBay, how the eBay example is great. And it is. It's a wonderful example. But eBay had everything working for it. It has a closed community, and you have both the carrot and the stick, right? If you take part in the ODR process, you're going to get access to certain things. If you don't take part, you're booted off the platform. It's not that black and white, but that's basically it. So there is an impetus to take part in the process, whereas outside of closed communities like that of eBay, well, it's relatively difficult to encourage or motivate people to log on to a platform. So just to give you an example, the Equidia platform that I mentioned before, Electronic Consumer Dispute Resolution, it's a platform that my colleagues developed. This was prior to the lab coming into play. So this was in 2001, if memory serves me. So that was launched to great fanfare. It was ordered by the European Commission, and then so it was developed for them and put into a place and then housed in the UK. And the consumer protection agencies and the government bodies, everybody thought it was a great system, and the consumers loved it. But what happened in most cases, a consumer would log onto the platform, fill out the forms, an email would be sent to the merchant, and then the merchant would ignore it, saying, well, I'm in another jurisdiction, I don't have a reason to take part, even though this was a free service. So that has always been the issue with privately owned ODR platforms, is that as great as the system is, if you don't have a proper financial model behind it, and if you don't have a way to entice people to take part in the process, you're going to have very little demand for your offer. So that's why we said we had the hypothesis back when we launched the lab of saying, let's make it a public service and not a private offering by incorporating it into the legal process, by having it basically as a step prior to going to court. Well, now you don't have the financial issues anymore because it's funded by the state as part of the legal system. And the impetus is there as well. The imperative to take part is there because if you don't take part in the ODR process, when you finally reach the third stage, if you decide to basically forgo stages one and two, so no negotiation, no mediation, you go directly to the third stage, well, then the judge or the member or whoever, however you name the deciding party, well, the first question they're going to ask is, why are you here? Why did you not try to negotiate? Why did you not try mediation? Mm-hmm. And unless you have a good answer to that, then you might be penalized. That doesn't mean you're going to lose your case, but you might have to suffer some of the court costs, for example, because those court costs would not have arrived were it not for the fact that you decided not to go into negotiation or mediation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm just aware of your time and the usual span of these podcasts. But what I want to do is to close by going back out to a sort of a big picture question, which kind of relates to the legal and constitutional landscape of Canada. Canada is constitutionally committed to being multicultural. How do you feed that into cyber justice platforms?
There are different ways to do it. First of all, just a language issue, right? Canada has two official languages, French and English, so our platform is bilingual, so you can access it in French or in English. And then it's how you program the forms. So you have to be very cautious in the vocabulary you use, not just from a cultural standpoint, but also for an understanding from the standpoint of ensuring that people understand the context. In Canada, like in most of the developed world, it is frightening to hear the statistics on how many people are functionally illiterate. So here in Canada, it's roughly half the population that's functionally illiterate.
Agreed.
And now that doesn't mean that people can't read or write. That means that they can read or write, but that they don't necessarily understand complex ideas. And so those have to be explained to them. Well, is there anything more complex than legalese? Mm-hmm. Right? Especially when we like to sprinkle a couple of Latin words in there to make ourselves feel a little smarter. But joking aside, it's very difficult for people to understand those. So basically, when we're working on adapting the platform with our partners, well, that's one thing that is taken into account. How do you make sure that the vocabulary that you use is understandable for most people and that it doesn't hurt cultural sensitivities and so on and so forth? So you have to concentrate on how you populate the fields in the forms that are being used. But that is something that, again, we work on with our different partners to make sure that the content is adequate. And the advantage of the way our platform is built is that they can also be modified very easily afterwards. So if after a couple of weeks we realize that, such and such a word that we used is being misunderstood or misconstrued, or it's actually hurtful to a certain portion of the population, there's always the possibility to change that word and replace it. And this can be done by secretarial staff. It doesn't need a computer programmer to do it.
Yeah. And presumably, in addition to French and English, there's a significant renaissance of First Nations in Canada, less so in the US, certainly here. And here, Maori, and the indigenous Maori language, is one of our three official languages, Maori, English, and New Zealand Sign Language, which would be that last one would be a little hard to do on some platforms. So presumably the First Nations issues and interests would need also to be incorporated in whatever platform design that you have going.
So we to my knowledge, have not had a request for that yet. But basically, the way our platform is built, it can be adapted to any language that is written from left to right. And that's using the classic alphabet. If you start using a different alphabet, then we would need to adapt things. But it's not something that we would be against. It's just that the request has not been made yet.
Right. I missed also your comment on the alarming level of functional illiteracy, because just in this last week, there's been a concern here about the number of school kids whose level of attainment of the English is literacy, numeracy, and one other. But basically those first two, but the level of attainment is very low. And one of the solutions proposed is to reduce the tests and to make the tests easier. I think, okay, so you're going to get higher pass rates at a lower level. But as an old educator, that just alarms me that thought should even enter the minds of the educational authorities. We get a better pass rate, but you still get people who can't read or write or do their sums. Nicola, there's some intriguing stuff you're doing here, and I would love to keep in contact with that latest project that you're working on as well, so which I can do through the emails that I receive from the laboratory. But in the interest of time, I'm going to need to wrap up this conversation and to allow you to get on with the rest of your day. But thank you so much for your time. It's been intriguing to find out what you're doing. Well, find out what the laboratory is doing from someone who's actually at the heart of it. So thank you so much for taking time to chat today, and good luck with your future work.
Thank you, and it was a great pleasure.
This podcast has been brought to you by ICODER, the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution. To learn more about ICODER or to become a supporting member, please visit our website at icodr.org.